Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of Reckless to Talk, our TTRPG interview show where we sit down with some of our favorite writers, players, GMs, and streamers to get to know a little bit more about what makes them who they are. I am, as always, your host, GM Nathan. I use he, him pronouns, and I am overjoyed to bring you this week's episode with tabletop designer, producer, GM, and performer Elliot Davis. Elliot's name may be familiar to our listeners as one of the co-founders of Many Sided Media, helping create shows like My First Dungeon and Talk of the Table. He is also a successful game designer with games including Rom-Com Drama Bomb, Project Echo, Abominations, and Welcome to the Silly Goose Convention. He is also currently crowdfunding The Time We Have, a game about two brothers in a zombie apocalypse on opposite sides of a closed door learning to say goodbye. Elliot and I have a great conversation about getting specific in your game design, working with people you care about, producers as therapists, learning what to leave out, and just generally living an artistic life. It's a really special conversation, and I got a lot out of it that I'll be carrying with me for a long time, and I sincerely hope you all will too. As always, if you enjoy this episode, please go check out some of our other Reckless to Talk interviews and maybe even one of our actual play episodes. We have links to all the things that Elliot and I talk about in the show notes, including links to the currently funding The Time We Have, which again, side note, please feel encouraged to pause this episode and go back that game right now. With that, thanks for listening, and I'll see you all next time. Hello there.
Hello.
Ooh, that had some good pizzazz to it for a first introductory sound clip. Thank you. Thank you so much for starting with that energy.
Of course, we're here to have a good time, and I know what you need.
A lot of upward inflection is the key to all good podcast times.
The people love upward inflection.
Elliot, I am super, super excited to chat today. It's also one of those interviews where I'm like, where you consume a bunch of audio only content from someone. And then now it's like, oh, and now there's like a face attached to it. And also that face is like responding to me. You're a good example of that. If I've consumed so many individual episodes of you either talking or making weird little voices that now it's like a real delight to actually see you as a human being instead of just little wave files.
If I could just be an ethereal being of wave files, that'd be great. But unfortunately, I do have to have a face.
Wave files and silly little voices.
Yeah. That's what I'm working towards.
When we upload our consciousness to some sort of like database, let the listeners hear that waveform is our preferred storage.
Do not make me an avatar. I want to be sound. Yeah.
No, thank you. But hey, Elliot, you know, I think it's important context for those who may or may not be, again, uploading your consciousness to some sort of like computer algorithm in the future, as well as, I don't know, like our listeners or whatever in the present tense, to know a little bit about who you are and the things that you do. So could you please tell all of those listeners now and in the far future what it is that you do?
Yeah, so my name is Elliot Davis. I go by More Blueberries online as a publisher, as a designer. You can hear me play, GM, and produce. I guess you don't hear me produce on My First Dungeon.
Sometimes it depends on the episodes and the structure, I think.
Depends on the episode.
You show up sometimes.
You can feel me. And then I host and produce Talk of the Table, and I do both of those things as part of Many Sided Media, which is a TTRPG podcast production company. And then I publish games and I design games, games like Project Echo and Rom-Com Drama Bomb and the upcoming game, The Time We Have.
I think is out as of the release of this episode. It's still actively crowdfunding and stuff.
As of the release of this, it is currently crowdfunding. Yes.
As your listed resume has already suggested, you do a lot of stuff. Elliot, a lot of stuff and tabletop stuff specifically that you like actively do, let alone have done in the past, all of which are ripe for kind of diving into. But that's not the talk approach. Mm. The a hyphen approach. No, no, we start. I don't know how I feel about that one.
No, well, it's, I love a verbal joke spoken out loud. It's really good.
Yeah, exactly. It's very good. It's very good. But that's not where we start. You know, we're exploring the whole person. We're not just exploring what the latest project is, all that stuff, though we'll be talking about that, of course. We go to the heart of things, where things started. When you first began to bloom as a nerd and or tabletop role-playing game individual. So however your personal narrative best starts, how did you get introduced to tabletop role-playing games and or just, you know, kind of start doing nerdy stuff such as that?
Two slightly different answers. I mean, I guess that nerd stuff has always been a thing for me. I come from a family of three brothers. I have two older brothers, and I was exposed to a lot of fantasy and sci-fi and games from them. Interestingly enough, nobody in my family ever knew about Dungeons and Dragons or tabletop role-playing games, even though in hindsight, I'm always like, everybody would have loved this.
You're that kind of nerd. Yeah, you should have done this.
Yeah. Everyone in my family is that kind of nerd. Like, my mom loves the Matrix trilogy. Like, that's one of her favorite series of movies. And my brothers are huge Lord of the Rings heads. And my oldest brother is a big World of Warcraft guy. But never got into TTRPGs until I was under lockdown in the pandemic in 2020.
Tale as old as time, baby.
Tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme. Yeah, my roommate at the time, who is Behold, the musician that I work with a lot and we work with on My First Dungeon, Colin, we live together and we're old friends. And he was getting back into a Pathfinder game that he had started in college and was just talking to me in general about D&D, and he was watching Critical Role. And meanwhile, I had two other friends who were getting into NADPOD and were getting into early seasons of Dimension 20. And so I had kind of these three close friends of mine who all were like getting touches of tabletop, and they were like, let's play a one-shot. Like, let's play a D&D one-shot. And we did this very silly one-shot about a wizard that was turned into a lamb. I think it's like a very classic starting adventure for people. I can't remember what it's called, but
I think I know the exact adventure that it is. It is, nope, I'm not coming up with it, nor am I spending airtime trying to come up with a name, but I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah. So we did that, and then we ended up
a sheep chase. Sheep chase, I think is what
sheep
it's called.
Chase. That sounds right. That sounds right. And so we did that, and I made my first ever D&D character whose name was Wardwoo Silwan, which is an anagram of Woodrow Wilson for some reason. I don't particularly like Woodrow Wilson. I just liked how it sounded.
You know, not that I'm an expert on kind of the Elliot Davis fiction experience, yeah, but that does kind of fit what would become the vibe, I feel like, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's kind of, that is, I didn't even think about that. That is kind of my vibe. It's like, well, I don't like Woodrow Wilson, but this sounds funny. We got into a long-term D&D campaign. Then I started DMing, I guess, at the time, a Ravnica campaign, which is still my favorite D&D setting. And then I believe Colin showed me a video of Dice Breakers, like 10 RPGs that are not D&D. This is like a 2020 video with the host who was no longer there the last couple of years. And then obviously rest in peace Dicebreaker as a whole now. But that video was kind of an early exposure, kind of three early exposures all happened at the same time. I saw this video and Colin was like, I'm kind of interested in this game, Blades in the Dark. I was like, yeah, that sounds dope. And then I started going to 20 Sided Store in Williamsburg, which is my favorite local game store and a very, very dear place to me. And I was exposed to indie RPGs a lot through their RPG section. They've always stocked a lot of indies. And the first non-D&D book I bought was Kids on Bikes. And that was the first sort of the beginning of, if you could see the whole of my room, there are four full shelves of RPGs now. But Kids on Bikes was the first non-D&D book on those shelves. And then TikTok was big for me. TikTok was a big way that I got exposed to indie RPGs, the Beggar Talk community. I often tell Kendrick Smith of Kendo Makes Films, Tales Yet Told, that Kendo was a big influence for me in 2020. He was doing a lot of like shelf updates and talking about Powered by the Apocalypse and stuff. And now it's funny because we're friends and collaborators, but like it's very full circle. So yeah, so I, pandemic, needed something fun to do to stay connected with my friends, as is the story for, I think, so many people. And then through a combination of, you know, YouTube, TikTok, and a really cool game store, was like, hey, indie TTRPGs are pretty cool.
So I'll ask like a more pointed, personal, exploratory, soulful version of this question probably a little later.
Sure.
But I'm gonna start with the call out question, you know,
yeah,
kind
go,
of
go
the
ahead.
Confrontational journalist question. Four shelves of tabletop role-playing game books.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read them all?
Oh, no way.
Okay. I mean, same. Obviously
half on a
same.
Good day. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. which is very good,
yeah,
to
yeah,
be
yeah.
clear. But I mean, again, it's a meme. We all know it. We have way more physical and PDFs copies of things than we can possibly read.
Oh, we can't even talk about PDFs. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One bundle alone. And it's like, cool. There's a lifetime of reading.
Yep.
So you had pretty early, it seems like, in your tabletop exposure, been introduced to all the different genres and systems and approaches to tabletop role-playing games. So was there one in particular that really kind of like clicked for you, either as a designer, a player, or a game runner, or whatever, that really kind of took it from, oh, okay, here's what tabletop role-playing games are as kind of a crystallized structure to, oh, no, it can be like this or that or that, or what if we did this or blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, man, I'm trying to decide if there's a game I can identify. I think, like, honestly, the first non-D&D game that I GM'd was Honey Heist by Grant Howitt. And I ran it for some friends while we were on a vacation, and I brought crayons and I printed out all the like bear sheets and stuff. And I ran that game and I was like, oh,
mm-hmm.
You don't need everything D&D is throwing at you to do this thing of role-playing, of collaborative storytelling. Like there is so many other ways into it. And meanwhile, there was another TikToker who, Disaster Tourism, who I don't believe makes content anymore, which is a shame, but Disaster Tourism used to talk about like how they would design games by like thinking about objects around their house and like, how can I think about this like a game mechanic? I believe they have a game that is a trick or treat thing where you play with a bowl of candy, which was just really fun. And that was kind of like this idea of Honey Heist was like, okay, we can strip down a game into something a lot smaller than D&D. You don't have to make the 200 page book with, you know, 30 different people involved. Like Grant Howitt put Honey Heist out. It's a handwritten piece of paper with a very silly illustration of a bear.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, from that found the Zine Month community. And Zine Month was the first time that I was like, okay, I'm going to try this out. And I made a game called Abominations. And Abominations is a Scrabble tile powered game. Which,
yes.
I was familiar with the TTRPG Spell, which is another game that uses Scrabble tiles, but you use it to spell out different magics. And I, one night, and this has become very much my design style and the way I think about new game ideas, I spent a night unable to sleep for like 3 hours, writing the whole game in my head, getting up, grabbing my phone, putting something in my notes, trying to go back to sleep, getting up, grabbing my phone, putting in my notes. And the next day I walked across my apartment to my roommate, Colin, and I was like, I have a game idea. Here it is. Blah, 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 blah. And he playtested it with me. Like, he and his partner Lainey playtested it. And then I made my first game and I fully got addicted to that process.
So before we kind of get too deep into game design or performance or anything, looking back at that kind of first exposure to tabletop role playing games, kind of as a concept, what about that is a bit of self-expression, of performance, of creativity, of whatever? What about that really pulled to you, at least at the beginning?
Yeah, I am really fond of stories, and that feels very, I don't know, pedestrian or trite to say, but like I am just fond of them. I just love them. I was a film major in college. I spent a long time working in film production, and I've always just been like fascinated and drawn in by stories. Like, I'm very emotionally compelled by movies and books. And the first few times I played D&D, even that silly one shot we did, I was just amazed by the level of immersion into a story it was able to give me. The mm-hmm. fact that it was like, oh, I am getting the experience of watching a story and living it at the same time.
Yeah.
And it has been without fail the thing in my life that has been able to emotionally affect me in terms of entertainment in a way that nothing else has. Like, it's like, cause I'm involved. And like, I remember that game of Honey Heist I ran, my friends had a whole confrontation with Yogi Bear, who had killed one of their dads or something. and my friend got into like emotional role play in Honey Heist. And I remember just being like, what the fuck is this magic little thing that I have lucked into finding? And yeah, I think it's just like, I don't know. It's sometimes hard to describe what is so magic about it, but like, there's a lot of words about like that you can put a tie to it of narrative drift and different and the magic circle and all of that. But like, ultimately it's just like, it's a really good way to tell stories and create stories. And I just love stories.
Not pedestrian at all. You are describing a shared fundamental need across all of humanity in which we identify ourselves in a shared experience. Oh, what a nerd I am. You're good. Safe space. You're
one
all
of
right.
Those fundamentally human things I just happen to also like. Yeah,
I enjoy quite a bit. Yeah. And you're good here. So you're getting all of this exposure from all of these different places, these different games, consuming rules, playing through things. And boy, sure, a lot of time in, say, 2020, 2021 to be consuming and thinking about and doing all of these things.
100%.
But when was the point for you that it became not just like, oh, this is a great, fun thing to do, which is the case for most people, unlike sickos such as ourselves. And when did that move into creating something? Where did that kind of mindset start creeping in for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think of sort of my like creative trajectory in life of like, I've gone through many phases of wanting to just make a lot of stuff. Like, I've always just been really into making and creating. When I was a kid, I drew a lot. And then when I was in college, I got into Photoshop, really heavy, dove into Photoshop. I loved photo manipulation and photography. And I used to take like 500 pictures a day for like 2 years. It was just like an insane, lovely, beautiful thing. Like, the memories of those 2 years are stronger than any other years of my life, just because it's like thought so much about what I was looking at. Anyway, that's a whole thought on photography and like what photography means. But like, I've always just like moved through different modes of creation. I did some 3D design for a while, and then I got back into drawing in my 20s. And when games came along, I was just like, this feels like the culmination of all these things that I have loved about creating in all these other mediums. Like, I am getting to write. I am getting to, you know, if I'm making a small thing, I'm getting to draw and think visually. But overall, it's just like, it is combining the narrative thought patterns of all these other forms of creation into one thing. And so as I started to discover that, like, not only are there games that aren't D&D, there are games that are small. And there are games that are small and meaningful and mighty. And then the real key turn was finding the indie RPG community that, you know, has had some dispersion with the loss of Twitter that it used to be. You know, we're a little bit more scattered online. But when I, you know, first discovered it in late 2021, I guess, I was a Twitter lurker for a while. And then I found the Zine Month Discord. And I just went all in on making abominations. And I was like, no matter what, I am going to print this. I am going to make this physical. Like, I did a pre-sale on Itch. I didn't crowdfund. I just released it on Itch, and you could pre-order the prints. And what I was like is like, whether 2 people buy this or 20 people buy this, I'm going to print these zines and I'm going to make them. And I want to, I just want to take this thing to physical. And so then there was an amazing amount of resources with Zine Month. It was like, you know, Tony Vicinda and Charlie Fergraves and a bunch of other fantastic people who were sharing insights into just like how they do this thing. And I will forever be grateful for Tony Vicinda's press kit video, which is the reason I'm able to do this at all like a business, because I made a press kit for Abominations when I like hadn't done anything. And I got like one little feature in a roundup on Dicebreaker, but it just meant the fucking world. It all meant so much, you know, then. And after I did one, I couldn't stop.
I would actually like to briefly do a detour back to photography stuff. Just because I do appreciate the sentiment of tabletop role-playing games being a great avenue to smush together a bunch of different creative, artistic, and or practical pursuits, you know, of everything from certainly doing art and thinking visually to consume a bunch of books and therefore you know kind of how a story can or should go, or improv. And photography is, I think, an interesting example that is very obviously artistic and very obviously something that is valuable to me, but I don't know that it gets brought up very much in terms of like who I am as a tabletop creator. You know what I mean? Like I don't hear that super often. Can you just talk a little bit more about, yeah, your relationship with doing something like photography, which is this sort of, again, what seems at face value to be a sort of different part of a brain, a different part of a creative process, mm-hmm. And what it means to you and kind of you as a holistically creative individual?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's a few things, some of them specific to photography and some of them just more generally about creativity and creation. And I think one of the things that photography taught me and my photography practice and hobby and artistic pursuit was a level of creative output, like self-disciplined creative output of yeah. like, I am going to carry my camera with me all the time. I'm going to take pictures. And at the end of most days, I'm going to put them on my computer and I'm going to pick at least like 10 or 20 that I like. And I'm going to hold on to them and I'm going to look at them and I'm going to think about what I like about them. And I'm going to do that every day or most days, you know, and that this idea of like the confidence to create, I think, is like a hard thing for people sometimes. It's just like, I don't have anything to say. I don't have, you know, something I want to make. And I think that a camera is this beautiful thing that allows you to go out into the world and create with anything. I shot a lot of pictures in my hometown. I spent a summer in my hometown in college when I first had my camera. And so I was just home taking pictures every day because I was like, well, I'm going to do something. And the camera just like, you know, allows even a space that you know as well as your hometown, you can just like find little nooks and crannies and, you know, perspective. And I think that photography specifically as an art when it comes to relating to game design is this idea of like, to make a pun, unfortunately, it's focus. Like, you know what I mean? Like game design is finding an aspect of a kind of story you want to tell, a kind of experience mm-hmm. you want to elicit, and focusing in on that and making sure that like your mechanics and your visuals and your writing all are focusing towards that. And like with a camera, you are trying to tell a story by narrowing in on a piece of an environment or a person or a specific angle with lighting and the rest. You have to think about like, what am I leaving in and what am I leaving out? And that I think is a thing that photography probably most in terms of like an esoteric creative thing mm-hmm. taught me how to like leave some things out, which is a really big challenge with game design. You know, any game designer will tell you that scope creep and bloat are huge. And it's finding like what fits in the frame of this game. What is the bare minimum thing that will get the point across that I'm trying to make? Like it, because a picture of a crowd of people can be really cool, but a picture of a crowd of people where like you've specifically decided to put one person in focus says something very different.
Oh, I think absolutely. I think that's valuable perspective, knowing the games that you have created where they are extremely like, no, we are doing one thing.
Right.
And it is very specific and it's a very specific genre and vibe. And everything is really tightly designed to enact this hyper-specific fiction, which I think is especially true with your last two or three games, but I think with all of them. So I think that's really valuable insight for certain. So you had put out Abominations and had gotten the tabletop role-playing game brainworms that were just like, well, obviously this is the thing that I do now.
Yeah.
So at that point, were you considering doing any sort of performance kind of deal? Or were you like, no, I'm just going to be doing game design and still obviously playing games and interacting with them. But obviously you are a quadruple threat of a tabletop role-playing game individual now, but not necessarily then. So what was your mindset at that point? And how did the scope creep of tabletop role-playing game content creation begin for you?
Yeah, I mean, so for context, my day job for from 2020 until the beginning of this year when I finally left it was I was a podcast producer for a company that made podcasts for brands. So my paying full-time job was podcast production. And so I have a history in video production, but I learned podcasting between 2020 and 2022. I was making like a daily podcast for a while. So I really just like went through the ringer of like, how do we make a podcast sound good? How do we like do all these like logistics of production? That was like the professional context underneath all of this like new joy from games. That job, you know, there's a lot of mixed feelings when you look at the arc of 4 years at a place. I learned a lot about podcast production. But really to the journey to performer starts with somebody else you've spoken to, who's Brian Flaherty. The thing that happened with Brian to make our meeting story maybe somewhat brief is we met pre-pandemic through a friend. I went to his show and one of my friends from college was there and introduced us, became Instagram mutuals, didn't really speak after that. I was going to be in an art scene he was doing. Pandemic happened, didn't speak for a while. He started posting about 20-sided podcast in My First Dungeon on Instagram as I had just released Abominations. I started to notice he was doing this. And then I signed up for his newsletter and he put out an interview with Grant Howitt, who had done Honey Heist, and they had just done the second season of My First Dungeon where Shenouk GM'd Honey Heist. And I cold DM'd Brian. I was like, hey, don't know if you remember me. We met in 2020. I see you're doing cool game stuff. I just released this game. Do you want to get coffee? He was like, yeah, let's meet at Cafe Reggio, which is Brian. Anybody who listens to enough of Brian talk know that that's like his famous haunt of New York City.
He mentioned it in Reckless to Talk as well. And I think referenced it as something that he has talked about in many other interviews and something that is a known fact about him. So yes, it is officially like canonized as whatever the tabletop role-playing game equivalent of the IMDb like fun facts section is, that is on Brian's page for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. So much so that Brian owns a full tea set from them that his wife Abby gave him for Christmas last year. Anyway, Brian and I meet at Cafe Reggio. We sit down. We do the awkward, you know, first time meeting small talk thing. And then it's like, you want to talk about games? And then we end up talking for 5 hours that first day that we hung out. And we were talking about how he was getting into indie RPGs very surfacely, like had just discovered Honey Heist. And I'm like, oh, like I've been deep diving on this. Do you want to hear about this game and this game and this game? I'm also a game designer. Like I have this idea for a game called Something Is Wrong with the Chickens. And I gave him the pitch for Something Is Wrong with the Chickens. And he was like, that slaps. Do you want to come play it on the podcast? And like, it's funny the perspective now. Like I think about then I was like, oh my God, this like actual play podcast wants to play my game. Like
for
this
sure.
Is huge for me. I'm like, yeah, this is my big second game. Like he's taking a chance on me. The game's not even fully written yet, whatever. I'm like, yeah, let's do it. So I wrote the game and I think we recorded before it was even fully released. And I remember he got Shenouk and a handful of New York City based comedians. And I remember I was so nervous to go into that recording.
Of course.
Like, yeah. It's like I had only met Brian as a performer. Like he had hosted a show when I had met him. And then he was like, oh, these are like three New York City working comedians. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, that seems like a good thing. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And me, game designer, I'm just going to come and I'm playing too. Okay, cool. Yeah.
Very normal, very comfortable, like powered social dynamic for sure. Yep.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
all
yeah.
very good. Very normal.
But man, I mean, after that first day of Brian and I talking, I think that there have been very few days in the last 2.5 years now that we haven't talked. You know what I mean? Like it was like from that coffee, we became like collaborators and friends very quickly. And I think he mentioned this on his podcast. I was in his wedding earlier this year. Like he's now one of my best friends in the world. And the confidence to be a performer is something that I never would have had without like that first ask from him to like come play Chickens on the podcast. And then we had a good time together and he asked me to guest on the Wander Home season and we had a great time there. And then he was like, do you want to GM our Halloween season doing 10 candles? And I was like, yeah, that's terrifying, but yeah, I'd love to. Like that game was the turning point where the four of us realized like, oh, we really like making things together, and we do a good job at it. Like, we have good chemistry, you know, we're all, like, bringing our A game. And I think that was, like, those three seasons were, like, a very natural journey for me to being like, oh, I could never be on mic talent, you know? I was, for context, making podcasts every day where I was, like, hiring hosts and, you know, helping guide people through interviews and stuff. But I was like, oh, that could never be me. To after those three seasons, I was like, oh, yeah, this is something I love doing. And I still have imposter syndrome. Everyone does. But, like, that was kind of how I went from just a game designer to now, like, oh, games and podcasts and performance coming together.
That Wanderhome was the first, like the first kind of standalone, not playing your own game experience.
100%.
Is like extra wild because that I listen to a ton of the Wanderhome series. That's wild to me because, like, all of the performances in that were so good that it's very funny to me that you're like, well, I don't know, I guess I'm trying this out, and it is what it is. We'll see what happens. Because again, it's all super strong, especially for something that you did not feel comfortable doing, I guess, immediately. So,
well, thank you. I mean, it's a huge credit to something that, like, Brian is very good at. I think Brian is very good at seeing things in people and supporting things in people. I think he's one of the most supportive people I know. And I think the fact that, like you said, that invite to play from, oh, you're not just inviting me because you're playing my game, like, you're inviting me because you had a good time, you know, working with me, and you want to work with me again. That was everything for confidence boost. And then going from player to GM was just another big confidence boost. And that's, like, performance is confidence, you know what I mean? Like, to get on mic and have presence and be entertaining for people, it's like, you gotta have that. And I don't always have it, you know, even now having done it. But yeah, it's like, Brian just really, you know, knows how to support people and see, I think, things in people, even if they're not seeing them.
This is now the point in the conversation where it's like, cool, I could ask about any of these eight topics we've already covered. So I'll try my best to continue to navigate it. I think, kind of just first and foremost, I'm curious, right now, snap back to current Elliot, as opposed to dipping his toe into podcasting, being on air podcaster, you do a ton of different stuff.
Sure.
Even just looking at game design and what you do on My First Dungeon and Many Sided Media generally, you do interviews, you are a player, you are a game master, you are a producer, you are designing quite a few games. I think this is the second or third game you've released in the last, what, like 18 months? Is that timeline correct? Like, year or two, basically.
Third game in 18 months. This will be the third major crowdfunding in 18 months.
Is all a hilarious amount of different things, different skill sets, different perspectives, different whatever. So in your heart of heart, while you do all of these things and do all of them well and prolifically, do you view yourself as one more than the other, or like a couple more than the other? Or does it just, whatever hat you're wearing that day, it's like, no, I am tabletop role-playing game Elliot, and whatever form that needs to be that day, that is a thing that I'm doing.
I think the fact that it's a hard question to answer means that I probably do change it up every day. But I mean, like, ultimately what I identify myself as first these days is a game designer. I think that's, like, generally in a given week what I am spending the most time on.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And really, I mean, at this point, you know, a lot of folks talk about this when they sort of take a step into making more of a business out of their game design. Most of what I am these days is a small business owner and thinking about all the things that go into that and, you know, filing expenses and shit like that. But the word that I love to come back to, and when I can zoom out and feel good about, is artist. Like, I just feel good about that word as, like, I feel like an artist in the various things I do. And I think it's a word I didn't always, like, feel like I had quote unquote earned. But I do feel like that is the best word. I go back and forth on whether I like the word creative as a noun, but I like artist.
It's been corrupted by capitalism, as have most things.
Yeah.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Hey everyone, Jonathan here with The Midroll. If you're looking for the hottest frog memes around, join the Reckless Attack community on Discord. You can find a link to it in the show notes of our latest episodes or on our website, recklessattack.com. Want to support the show? tell a friend, or check out our Patreon at patreon.com/recklessattack, where you can get access to our behind-the-screen talkback show, as well as our new Reckless of Snacks series, where we eat snacks, hang out, and just talk about whatever's on our mind. Thanks so much for listening to us, and we hope you enjoy the rest of the episode.
I feel like I'm skipping around a little bit, but also pulling on the thread in front of me. So I'll just do that. Something you talked about a little bit already in terms of photography, but also in terms of game design and of the imposter syndrome you felt going on and performing on a podcast, all that stuff. But I think the core part of that is that level of confidence to call yourself an artist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you have worked through, mm-hmm. continue to work through, or just what's your perspective on pushing through that barrier that I know a lot of people have of, yeah. again, like you said, are my ideas good enough? Are they unique enough? You know, am I making progress fast enough? Is it good enough? All of those kind of inherent doubts that go along with putting yourself out there like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple lessons here that I've had to learn or push myself through. And one of which is, like, since sort of rediscovering my love of, like, creativity and art when I was in college, because I was originally went to school to be an engineer, biomedical engineering. And I ended up transitioning to film when I decided that, oh, actually, I like making things better than creating bionic pancreases, which was an internship I had. And the thing I've always found is, like, because I've gone through these different phases of making different kinds of art, I have always considered myself somewhat of a generalist when it comes to creative pursuits.
Yeah.
For a long time, I looked at other artists and I longed to be a one thing person.
Yeah.
You know, because I think one thing people can be just so fucking good at that one thing in a way that, like, I just think that one of the things I've had to accept is, like, I don't know that there will ever be kind of a thing exactly like that for me. But I will say that, like, when I found games, it sure as hell felt like that was the closest I ever felt to the one thing for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, I don't know what it is. Things might change. But, like, it was like, oh, this is the thing that hadn't clicked with any of these other creative pursuits I've done. Like, it's like, I've liked them all. I've loved them all at times. I've made things I'm very proud of. But, like, it's like, this is, like, something that I want to drive my whole effort at as a medium. So that, I mean, is one lesson there that I've had to learn. And, I mean, the other thing is that, you know, nobody has any idea what they're doing and nobody believes in themselves. And every good person that you're jealous of one day decided to start calling themselves what they are. And that's the difference between them and you is, like, yes, a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of practice. But also there was a day where that person looked at themselves in the mirror and said, I'm a game designer now. Nobody else gets to bestow these things on you, I think, is the lesson that I learned. And it's something I tried to tell, you know, you can hear me sometimes on Talk of the Table say this to people, particularly our mutual friend Jay Stroutman. I said this last year, is, like, you made a game, you're a game designer.
Yeah.
And that's a lesson that I've taken from somebody else who I'm quoting but can't remember. But it's like, every single person who is an artist in the way you want to be an artist at some point was just like, yeah, I'm an actor, I'm a performer. And, like, that's a huge portion of the battle, is just being willing to call yourself it. And, like, nobody else can tell you when to do that.
Yeah, I absolutely. I feel like early on in this kind of recent wave of tabletop stuff that kind of we were all a part of was the bigger conversation of, if you are a GM, you are a game designer, right?
Right.
And, like,
right.
And pushing the boundaries of, like, what does any of these titles mean? It only means that you're doing the thing.
Yeah.
And that's it. And it doesn't matter your prolificness. It doesn't matter how successful you are. It doesn't matter all these other things. It is, like, are you doing verbs?
Yeah.
That are any way related to this? Great. You're doing it. Congratulations. Like, well done.
100%.
Find your beauty in that.
I totally agree.
You kind of describe tabletop role-playing games as, like, an umbrella, like, artistic pursuit, right? As, like, oh, this is the thing,
yeah.
Right? The thing that I am doing, the thing that I am, air quote, specializing in. That includes 18 other different skill sets and parts of brains and,
sure.
and whatever. But something that I always find really interesting about how My First Dungeon and Many Sided Media does things, your experience and just kind of what you do generally, is how you rotate kind of responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you are running it. Sometimes you are playing. Sometimes you're producing. You're also, again, you're game designing, you're interviewing, you're blah, blah, blah. I know I definitely have learned a lot as an interviewer, as doing all these other things in a way that helps inform all the other parts of my tabletop role-playing game brain.
Yeah.
So first, is that something that you have noticed kind of in your own tabletop creative journey, how those kind of things work together? But also then specifically, is there anything that you really have like figured out, I guess, as those webs have made connections, you know, that has been really valuable to you that might be valuable for other people?
Ooh, yeah. I mean, the short answer is yes to all of the above. They right. all inform each other all the time. The sort of specifics of which I was talking to Thomas Manuel recently about this, where we had a chat on Yes Indeed, and being an actual play blank, all the forms of actual play participation has made me a very narrative focused game designer, because mm-hmm. I think that actual play forces me to think about how can we tell, you know, a compelling story with arc and resolution and conflict and interest in, you know, 90 minutes, 2 hours, 3 episodes, 4 episodes. And then I very much make games that are, how can I help you, the player, tell a satisfying narrative experience kind of in this isolated chunk, whatever that is. For rom-com, it's obviously 90 minutes. For Project Echo, it's kind of at your own pace. And for this upcoming game, it's probably about 90 minutes to 2 hours as well. So I think that like being a creator of actual play and somebody who thinks about how can we make games entertaining, I try to help people have narratively satisfying game experiences as a game designer. And then, I mean, I think the people I get to interview on Talk of the Table, I think I learn so much from every single person. It'd be kind of impossible to identify just one thing, because I think every conversation on Talk of the Table has changed me in some way as a game designer, as an actual play producer. I mean, most recently, I can think of Alex Roberts, who is the designer of For the Queen and Starcrossed. And we talked a lot about the connections that Alex sees between traditional family card games, just like a deck of card games, and the design and thought around For the Queen, that it has that same sort of activation energy of like you pick up the deck and you play in the same way that you pick up a 52 card deck. So, yeah, I mean, I think that everything about it is a learning and makes each one better.
And I think that leads me to kind of my next question. You guys now have played so many different systems and turned it into actual play and done so in relatively limited scope. Again, I think they're usually anywhere 4 to 8 to 12 episodes or even less. And that has always been something that is very interesting to me, is how games either do or do not lend themselves to being an actual play, especially an audio first actual play.
Sure.
For you, as someone who both has run and been part of producing a lot of games, has read a lot of games, has made your own games, and has interviewed a bunch of people for either games that you guys have played or games that you just think are neat and are cool to talk about across all the various shows that you do, do you have any thoughts on what makes a game good, air quotes, interpret accordingly and as generously as possible, conducive maybe for an actual play, at least kind of from your perspective?
Yes, I do. I think that, and this is taste, so I don't want anybody to come away from this thinking that I think there are games that are bad for actual play, because ultimately, I think you could probably make a cool actual play out of just about any game if you put some thought into it.
Right.
That said, the kinds of games that I think are good for actual play are also the kinds of games that I love the most to play. Yeah. And this is something that I think you'll hear from me and Brian and Chenook and Abby kind of publicly, is that like we get absolutely amped on games that every single element of them are all driving towards one thing, like theme, art, layout, production, and mechanics are all pushing towards the same thing. I think like when I can feel that in a game, I know that we can make it sound good in an actual play. It's like, oh, because no matter what aspect of this game we're engaging with, like Orbital Blues, no matter what part of that book we're using, it's going to feel like we're telling an Orbital Blues story, you know, like,
yeah.
And I think if there's a most important factor for me, I think that thematic game mechanics are extremely meaningful to me. I think that because like an actual play, you and this isn't always the case, but like you often don't want to fully hide the mechanics. And because of that, you want your engagement with the mechanics to be on theme and on fiction.
Definitely.
And part of the entertainment. And I think that that's been true of pretty much every game we've played on My First Dungeon. I'm thinking right now of Nine Lives to Valhalla, which is every roll something dies. You could say that sentence to me and tell me nothing else about the game, and I'd be like, that'd make a good actual play.
Like, yeah, sold. It's 100%. Like, yeah. I'll listen to that right now. Let's get hooked up.
Yeah, there's juice there. So yeah, so there's that. And then, I mean, like, there is a certain unidentifiable X factor also. I think that, like, sometimes I will read a game and I will just be like, yeah, we have to make an actual play of this. You know, like, Wildseed was one of those games. Mm-hmm. We flipped through it and we, you know, we met Felix and it was just like, this needs to be told through actual play. There's a certain feeling sometimes we get where it's like, oh, this game actually needs that. Like, that is like, It is begging to be told in this format. So that's like the more esoteric answer, is that some games just have an X factor.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think a lot of games sing best when they're being played. You know, like All four reading games, truly, like, we talked about this recently in a couple episodes of like, can you judge a game just by reading it, mm-hmm. and having an idea of kind of what it would probably play like? And I'm very much in the camp of like, yeah, I think you can read a game and kind of get a feel for it. But there are games where it's like, oh, feeling it actually work the way that it seems like it would.
Yeah.
Is a special extra X factor, kind of like what you're saying. And some definitely just beg for it.
100%. 100%.
As you are writing a game, and like you said, there's a lot of stuff that lends itself to AP that are just things that you think are neat in games, and therefore obviously is something that you'll be pursuing. Since you now have been so steeped in kind of the like, ah, yes, I'm reading a game and also making an actual play of it, and here's how all of these things are intersecting and whatever, how would this play in an actual play? Does that enter into your brain at all as you are designing? Or just is it like, I am making this game, mm-hmm. and I am making it in a way that is pleasing to me, that I know works for actual play, but It doesn't really enter your mind directly?
I think it varies from game design to game design. I think when I made Rom-Com Drama Bomb, like Rom-Com Drama Bomb was one of those games where it was like, this is kind of a game that wants to be actual played. Like, it is timed. It is based off of another genre of like entertainment, of rom-coms and action movies. I think that was honestly very top of mind in that design. Cause I think that like the ultimate experience I wanted with rom-com to have is like, you're pushed into a performer mindset a little bit. And so if you can get people who are performers on it, I think they'll have a great time. That said, I think that like the interesting conflict with my newest game, The Time We Have, is that there was a horrible irony to the fact that there are 9 actual plays going on during this crowdfunding campaign, but I have been apprehensive about whether this game will work well for actual play. It's a very intimate game. It's a conversation focused game. There's not a lot of action. There's not a great resolution. I mean, it's a tragic game, which, you know, tragedy can work, but like, there are things about this game where, like, when I looked at it, when it was the first draft was complete, I was like, I really hope people like making APs out of this, because I've got a lot of people excited to do it. And at the time of recording, I haven't heard any finished products. So maybe in a week I'll hear the first one and I'll be like, no, this is perfect for actual play. I was dead wrong. But like, in the thinking about the game, there's some things where I'm like, oh, the most quote unquote ideal version of a game being played for some games in my mind is like, I want to hear a really highly produced actual play of it. The most ideal version of The Time We Have is the quiet game you play with someone you really trust and never tell anybody else about. Like, that's kind of the real shift with this game, is that like, it's almost like I think about it like, I don't want to make this too friendly to actual play because it would dull the teeth on it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so it's very game to game, ultimately, of like whether I think about actual play. But it is, I guess, whether I'm thinking about it in the push towards or push away, it is always, I can't erase the actual play producer in my mind, I think, fully when I'm game designing.
Something that I always find interesting is how people present differently in different roles, or what kind of skills they offer, or what kind of interest they have in different roles. And I guess the super broad question version of this is, Was there anything that you really like about each of the roles that you're like, oh, and this is why I love to produce, or this is why I love, you know, we've talked about gaming a little bit. We talked about the GMing part of it, that sort of thing. Or was there something that kind of surprised you where it's like, oh, I learned this about myself that I really like this, or boy, I like GMing. Fucking hate this part of it for the actual play, whatever. You know, like, what have you learned about yourself, I guess, is the real question. You know, as you've had to put on so many different hats and be in so many different roles and do it with certainly a core group of people, but rotating cast members, rotating systems, new interviews each week and all that kind of stuff. So what have you discovered about yourself, I guess?
Oh, I think that to take the positive route of this, I think that I've learned I am pretty good at focusing on different aspects of my brain or aspects of the process that I need to care about. And I think that player, GM, producer are three angles on the same thing.
In
that, like, when you're a player, you are thinking about, on the one hand, what is narratively satisfying for your character, and you are, and you are living in the character and you are reacting as the character. And I find that, like, as a player, the focus is very much on, like, what am I doing and how can I best react and support to my fellow players? As a GM, it's like, what is everything doing that isn't them? And how can I support all of these people? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's like, I think as a player, you get to focus on, you know, one or two people at a time in reaction and listening in things like that. In a GM, you kind of have to think about everybody, and you, and you have to play off everybody, and you're thinking very big. And then the producer, you get to take this fun step away from everything, and you get to look at all of them together and think, I actually don't need to worry as much about the people. I get to think about the product. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, there's some root word connection here, but, like, I am thinking about this as an entertainment product. I'm thinking about pacing. I am thinking about pickups. I am thinking about how can I, yes, support the GM as a person, but also how can I help the GM make the best possible thing they want to make? I love getting to actually jump between them. I think I miss the others when I'm not doing them. I think that, like, sometimes when I'm not producing, I miss having that 30,000 foot view. When I'm GMing, I really miss being a player and getting to just kind of lean into the mechanics in that way. I think that's the other thing about, like, specifically our medium and what we do is, like, as a GM, you have to know so many mechanics. You know, you just, like, you really, you got to be kind of the authority. Even in a show like ours where we're educating on mechanics, you know, where it's okay if we, like, fuck them up and things like that, you still got to be kind of an authority and you need to know more than the players. Whereas, like, when I was a player on Orbital Blues, I found so much joy in just getting to master my character sheet. Like, that is great. That is so fun when you get to just, like, be like, oh, these are all the things my character does. And that, you know, performance-wise, I have to think about everybody, but mechanics-wise, I get to just think about me. GMs, it's like, oh, performance-wise, I'm thinking about me, and I'm thinking about everyone's mechanics and my mechanics. And then producer, it's kind of a less mechanics-focused role in our, you know, like, our producers will be, like, they'll be rules checkers if, like, if the GM needs it, but, like, ultimately, the producer role is a very, very narrative-forward role. So, yeah, I think it's, like, it's been really fun to push those different parts of my brain, because producer is what I did, like I said, for my day job for a number of years. And so it's been fun to take that job that I did for a long time and apply it to something I love of, like, oh, here's all these things that I used to do for brands, quote unquote, for evil. And now I get to do it for fun and joy and entertainment.
That is something that's always been really interesting to me about you guys. And I think just a lot of podcasts generally or shows generally that have that producer or dramaturg or whatever kind of, like, auxiliary off-screen person role, because that's not something that everyone has. Yeah, I'm curious just to get a little insight, certainly for me and for anyone listening, about how you guys utilize that sort of a person, again, especially coming from you who did that before the podcast and had, you know, kind of had a degree of insight going in about what can make that sort of a position successful.
We've talked a bit about this on Chinook, and I did a Patreon exclusive for the Wild Sea where we did, like, a debrief on the season, because that was our That was our first season since being Many-Sided Media, where we had a producer. The previous iteration of this was I was a producer on the Die season, which was kind of the origins of Many-Sided Media as a company, was me being a producer on that season when Brian GM'd. And, you know, the producer is a lot of things. And like any producer of like, you know, TV or podcast will tell you this. It's like, and I think I got this advice from someone when I was working in TV from a producer, where it's like, I need to be whatever somebody needs me to be at a given moment. And I think that's very much the case here in AP. And somebody was recently telling me about a conversation they had where some folks were talking about feeling like they wanted, you know, a GM therapist, you know, like for their show or for their table or something.
Definitely.
And the person I was talking to was about, I think they're talking about a producer. And it's like, yeah, it's like that is one of the roles, you know, like Shanook and I talked very publicly about, like, I had a lot of anxiety about GMing the Wild Sea season. I had GM'd Den Candles, but this was the first like marquee season that wasn't being GM'd by Brian. And Brian has very big shoes to fill. He's an incredible talent. And so I had a lot of anxiety about it. And Shanook was very, very supportive throughout the process. So that's a huge aspect of the producer role, is like, how can we offload some of the emotional weight of the GM job so that we're not burning out every season? You know what I mean? Because I think that that was a little bit of where we were at, is that like our GMs were getting to the end of a season and like collapsing from all the work, you know? So it's a way to avoid burnout. It's a way to support. Also, it is somebody who gets to think just about the story during recordings. They don't have to worry about reacting. They can think about, does this support the story? Are we, you know, playing a card too soon? Oh, did you consider throwing, like, my classic producer move, and Brian has said this, is that I will just throw a line or an idea out in our Discord chat if, like, I feel like there's a narratively satisfying, like, button to put on a scene or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that the key to good producing is that you have to have a system. You don't want to be, like, in your GM's face. And, like, we have a very good system of, and this has been found through trial and error, of Brian is, like, don't intro or question any ideas you have. Just drop them in the chat. And if I want to use them, I will use them. If it doesn't make sense, I won't. And it's been a great system for us of just being able to be like, hey, this person says this. I think that producing removes a lot of ego also, I think, is the idea. It's like, when you're producing, you don't necessarily care about getting credit for the thing you do. And like, that there is a freedom in that, of just like, you know, if you have an idea or if you have a thought for the season, you're helping the GM look good. And that's great. And that's actually like part of the joy. And that helps you like kind of remove the ego. And I think like as a group, we're very not ego driven as the four of us. And I think that the fact that the producer is always one of us and the GM is generally one of us, if not always, means that there's that trust there to solve everything. And then I think like kind of the last thing that the producer can be is the producer is a great bad guy if you need to give feedback or direction to a table. Not like that we've ever had to be like really harsh on a table or like give really hard feedback, but even like the smallest feedback to someone who is in a very vulnerable position as a player, because a player role, it can be very vulnerable. You can get very real with your emotions. To have something like a note that feels very clinical come from your GM can kind of taint the relationship between GM and player that you need to be very built on trust. And I think when you can have somebody who feels more removed come in and be like, hey, for this session, keep this in mind. You're not thinking about the fact that that note came from your GM the whole session. You've just absorbed that note as like a, this is a thing for the production for all of us, including the GM. We're all on the same level of like how we have to like, quote unquote, fix something. You know, it's never big problems, but like it is a really valuable person to be able to drop in and say like, one of Brian's lines lately has been, I can't hear your face, which is a great, great note for audio only performance. It's like, if you react, you got to react out loud.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a really excellent perspective, just because, again, it is often so very personal, so very vulnerable. There's the power dynamic of, yeah, the GM is kind of the one who's running the show, but also not. And we're all equal collaborators, except for sometimes when we're not. And we want you to throw ideas out there, but we might ignore some of your ideas.
Yeah.
and having someone there who is invested, who is present, and, you know, who knows all of this happening, but able to better triage it, I think.
Yeah.
Sounds like a delightful time.
And somebody to remind you when everybody needs to take a pee break.
Yes, absolutely. Also, very, very, very important.
Yeah.
So I want to talk now a little bit about the games that you are doing, in particular, sure. The one that you are actively crowdfunding, but also a little bit about the one that you had most recently crowdfunded. Something that really stood out to me as I was kind of looking at the scope of Elliot as game designer was really, I think the first like three or four releases were all pretty standard. It seemed like I threw him up on itch. I yelled about him in Discords and on social medias, and it exists. And, you know, I want people to play him and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas the last at least three have all been crowdfunded, have all had whole production trailers involved. Are you someone who likes kind of pushing the scope of involving more people, of just pushing the envelope generally as far as you're able to take it? Or is that just something that kind of was like, well, maybe I'll try it this way this time? How is that for you as part of your process?
Yeah, I mean, there's two forces here. One of them is that I always want to push myself creatively. I always want to push myself artistically to make... It is definitely an escalation, but ultimately what it comes down to is like with each game, I've tried to think about like what is the best physical version of this game to me, because, you know, I'm very fortunate to be in America where like making physical products as a game designer is relatively possible.
Yeah.
And I just love physical games. Like I think that like physical role-playing games, like the Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast box set is one of the most magical objects I own. Mm-hmm. When you bring a game into the physical world like that, there is something so, so, so special about it. And this is, I'm someone who started playing D&D remotely. Like games kind of started remote for me, but like still physical means so much to me. And so I'm always thinking about what is the best, most thematic, most comfortable, easiest activation energy, physical way to make this game. Also, what is the physical manifestation of this game that I would be happy to put on my shelf, like that I would love to look at every day?
Yeah,
because I do look at them every day. I've got my games on my shelves. Maybe that makes me an egomaniac, but like I love.
What are you talking about? I would have like five copies of my games just scattered through my apartment at all times so that at any moment out of the corner of my eye, I could be like, ah, there's my game.
I made sick. That.
game designer Nathan made that. Hell yes.
But also, you're right. I mean, like there is a certain amount of like, I made a zine and then I made a pamphlet and then I was going to make another zine, but my writing for Project Echo ballooned and it became a book. And then I made that book and I was like, I know how to make a book now. That's cool as fuck, actually. That actually just like objectively rips that I made a book and now I want to do that again.
Yeah.
And to be clear, Rom-Com was originally meant to be a zine, but I, as Brian will often make fun of me, don't know how to write zine length games anymore. So now I make books. And then I was really just like fucking delighted by For the Queen, which I played for the first time in March this year. And just this idea of like a game on cards. It all is on the cards. Like, you don't need to read rules. What do you mean? And so it's often been like, what is inspiring me? What am I excited about? What's the best version of this game? And then the dark side of this is that I'm also trying to make a business out of games. Yep. And the capitalistic forces tell me to make more and more ambitious products.
Yeah.
And I can't ignore that. Unfortunately, you know, I have to pay rent and I have to eat, and people will pay more money for nicer things. So there is always that twinge of darkness to the ambition of like, this is just what I kind of have to do to sell products, is I have to push them to be, you know, nicer and cooler and more interesting. But in terms of like working with more people, that has always been something I've wanted to do more and more of. And with each game, I've been able to work with more people each time. And that rules.
Yeah.
If there is an experience, anybody listening, if you can find an experience in your life where you get to pay people to do the creative, cool thing they're best at, that is the best feeling in the entire fucking world. Like getting to pay someone for their art rules, even if it's not a lot of money. Like I'm working on shoestring budgets, but like when I get to send someone money for like the artist I'm working with right now, like I'm so delighted to send them money when they send me a new batch of art. It's like, yeah, I want there to be business infrastructure for paying people to be creative, so I'm trying to make that on a small scale. Yeah, it's just, I don't know, be the kind of business you want to see is part of it.
Yeah, definitely.
But also like, and then like the Michigas around each release is I have really talented friends. I mean, that's like, that's why these releases look like there's so much behind them, because there is so much behind them. But also that's because I have really, really talented friends and peers that I've been able to make who are down to do a work trade for something, who are excited about the game and just want to help out. And I can't express gratitude enough for that. Colin obviously is Behold. Colin and I have known each other since we were like 6 years old. So it like there is part of it that is just the dumb luck of like having one of your closest lifelong friends also be like an immensely talented synth musician. Like,
yep.
That just rules, but
it's not nothing, but I mean, it's not, you know, nothing. You don't get, it does. It also, it doesn't count against you though. You know, like
yeah,
you're just taking yeah. advantage of the potential collaboration and friendship.
Well, and it's been such a delight specifically to tangent on Behold for a second. Like he and I got into non D&D games at the same time. Mm-hmm. And he also got into, you know, synthesizers really big at the same time. Like, and I remember we lived together in our 4-person apartment in Greenpoint on the highway that we paid like $700 a month in rent because it was small and crappy. I remember that he would be on one side of the apartment messing around with his synths, making these like very cool beats and loops. And I'd be on the other, like avoiding my job and making game ideas. And it's like now to be here doing games full time and like, he now has like over 50,000 Spotify listeners as Behold. Like, it's the coolest shit in the world.
Yeah.
It's the coolest shit in the world to come up like with your friends like that.
Yeah.
So shout out Behold just like one time.
Links to all of that in the show notes as per usual. So I want to talk a little bit specifically about now a couple of your games. We're going to go in chronological order and we'll start with Rom-Com Drama Bomb. So my first and I think probably the most crucial question is which came first, the concept or the name?
The name.
Okay, good. I mean, if there was a correct answer, that was the correct answer.
Yeah. The name was a middle of the night divine intervention slapped into my brain phrase where I sat up and was like, the fuck is that? I guess that's a game.
So you do a lot of your best thinking just bolt upright.
I do a lot of my best thinking in bed in the middle of the night. Yeah, I would say 90% of my TTRPG work, like best ideas are when I am trying to sleep and can't.
So first, I guess just for the listener, kind of first and foremost, ever since it got announced, I've always been kind of like extremely into the premise of the game. But for those who aren't familiar, could you just do the elevator pitch of what Rom-Com Drama Bomb is?
Yes. Rom-Com Drama Bomb is a 3-player game in which two of you will play two people who should not fall in love. And the third person plays the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do.
You really rattled that off as if maybe you've said it a few times on various podcasts
just
before.
Just a couple hundred, maybe.
But it's such a very cool genre specific but weird combination of things.
Yeah.
There's like rom-coms and there are a few games that do kind of romantic comedy setups and stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, there are a lot of games that have some amount of like, oh, and there's an outside third party who is the secret puppeteer doing all of these things. But to cram them together is such a specific, albeit a wonderful and brilliant choice. So where did that idea come from? And that can just be at face value, where did it come from? But also, what's the sort of dynamic that you were looking to kind of explore?
Yeah.
When it's not just a romance story that shouldn't happen. It's not just a weird puppeteer. It's like, no, these are all like linked absolutely and with steel chains together throughout the course of this game.
Yeah, I mean, I think like to say that this came from the title is very true. And like it was sort of in my brain, like, rom-com is one half of this game. I know what that looks like. What is Drama Bomb? And Drama Bomb immediately became a like Doofenshmirtz-esque villain in my head mm-hmm. that had put bombs on rom-com leads. And I think that like one of the delightful things about rom-coms is that they are so absurd in structure and premise. Rom-coms are not what falling in love looks like. Like to be so clear, like you can have rom-com feelings and like you can like assign sort of this narrative to it, but like it is an absurd way to fall in love when you look at most rom-coms, to the point where you're like, a lot of this is like psychologically fucked that what these people go through.
A lot do not hold up under the 2020s gaze.
No,
for sure. Probably don't even hold up under the early 2000s gaze at this point.
Yeah, and it's just kind of there's something fun about the absurdity of that to me, of just like, and I think that like I was thinking a lot about this idea of like, what if a director was desperate to make a rom-com, because we don't have great American rom-coms these days, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we're out of the You've Got Mail, Harry Met Sally era by quite a few years. And even the 2000s, like 27 Dresses, like Katherine Heigl when she was on fire and in like 30 different movies, we're not in a big rom-com era. And so I was like, what if there was a director who was like, I need to make a rom-com, and I don't have a script, so what if I did it by force? And so that's kind of like these, all of these thoughts were swirling around about it. And then like when I really thought about it, and this is the dedication to the book, is to my mom, where the two kinds of movies my mom loved were rom-coms and like Jason Statham action movies, like Speed, which is Keanu Reeves. I don't want anybody to think I think that that's Jason Statham, Keanu Reeves.
I mean, to be honest, I'd watch the Jason. Well, I'd be interested to hear about the Jason Statham version of that. But
oh, yeah,
go on.
Me too. But it's like those were foundational. I was a big movie family. We didn't have TV for a number of years, but we loved movies. And if there's like two kinds of movies I absorbed the most growing up, it's rom-coms and action movies. And it's just like, let's slam them together and see what happens.
It's a very interesting game because, again, at face value, smash these two genres together. Take this already absurd situation of a romantic comedy and then make it more absurd in, like, add absurdity on top of it. Like, take the absurdity from action movies and then just, like, pour a little on top.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, like, inherently, like, okay, cool. That's a good direction. That's a good genre. But then to, like, turn it into what is a very specific and very fun and fulfilling play experience is kind of its own different thing.
Right.
And so, you know, you came up with the name, you came up with the general vibe as you were taking it from basic idea into here's a game.
Yeah.
What did the exploration of those ideas tell you about what the game was going to be, if that makes sense? Did you have an idea of what you were building towards, or was it like, oh no, this is a game that explores these themes or explores these sorts of relationships or these sorts of worldviews?
It started with the first pairing, right? Of like, how do we do Just Friends and how do we do Dr. Evil, this like Doofenshmirtz-esque figure? And it comes back to mechanics for me. Like a lot of like the exploration of what a game is about is in, you know, finding the mechanics and making sure that mechanics and theme are tied. And the mechanic I knew from the start for that game was the 90-minute timer. I was like, this has to be a timed game. Whatever else is true about this game, it has to be a timed game. And then because we're playing with this very big meta idea of a forced rom-com, that's where the act structure came in. That's where the scene structure came in. And when I was thinking about games that I felt like emulate that sort of experience I was hoping for, you know, Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast was a huge mechanical inspiration to me. The way that Bingos and Whoopsies work in that game
definitely
gives you so much character very easily. And I was thinking about, you know, how can we twist this? How can we twist this idea of moves? And like, that's where the Ticks and Booms came in. And then it was like, these are changing. And then I think it was Brian who gave me the idea for the mood dice when I was kind of talking to him one day where we were co-working. As I was like, I want to get these four moods into this game somehow. And I've been thinking about like, is it a dice system with D4 or is it like cards? You know, that was one of the thoughts initially, was like, is it cards, like four suits, four emotions? Like, do the different cards represent the emotions? And he was like, what if it's just a D4 that they like roll and the result is the mood? And I was like, oh yeah, that's great. And then that pulled that all out of like having to worry about it in the mechanics of the game. So then it made room for me to use this like belonging outside belonging, no dice, no masters, Yazeba's inspired token system. I've wanted to make for a while, and I still might eventually, but a game that is like gamifying the Pixar formula. You know how Pixar has put out their like, this is exactly how we make a movie. And I've always thought about like a belonging outside belonging game that is like,
yep,
let's make a Pixar style story. And so that's where like initially the idea of taking token powered play and applying it to a three act structure sort of came in. And so then it just felt right to bring that into rom-com. I think, I don't know if I took your question in too mechanical an answer.
I'm following. I'm with you.
Yeah.
that game is so interesting and fun. But also, again, I'll have links to playthroughs of it, including on My First Dungeon and many other places in the show notes. But part of the reason I wanted to talk about it, other than it's a great game and very interesting, is because it is a very stark pivot to the next game, tone-wise.
How do you mean?
Well, I'll be interested to see what you think about it, I suppose. But the time we have, which again is the game that you are currently crowdfunding for as of the release of this episode and will be available to buy long after that, I'm sure, but is very similar in a lot of ways, but also drastically different in a good number of ways as well. So similarly, could you do the little elevator pitch around what that game is, and we'll go from there.
The Time We Have is a tragic duet zombie TTRPG. It is a game about brothers in the zombie apocalypse after one of them gets infected and the final days before that brother turns. It's a card-powered game played on opposite sides of a closed door.
It's bonkers, first of all. It's a wild game. It's a wild concept that is also, I think, super perfect, and I think a super clear crystallization of what we started talking about, which was the looking around and noticing things.
Mm.
And like, how do I make this a game?
Yeah.
There's a door. How do I make that door a game? And here we are. Just to start with, what was the inspiration or that moment of, oh, here's a game.
Yeah.
That you know, caused all this to spiral out of it.
So it's funny, if like Rom-Com was this aggressively short development timeline of like, I quit my job in January, had the idea for the game, and then crowdfunded it a month later. The Time We Have is an idea that the first seeds of, I checked my notes recently, is a 2-year-old note in my phone of what started out as a solo journaling game about processing your loved one turning into a zombie. That was the initial seed of an idea. And obviously, I was very interested in solo journaling games for a while. I ended up making Project Echo. And then at some point, the note changed to a 2-player game about two people who were survivors together in the zombie apocalypse. And it was going to be a normal deck of playing card based game. And I had this thought of splitting the deck and sliding it under the door. I was like, ooh, that's juicy. I love the idea of like sitting on opposite sides of a door, like you're quarantining and sliding these cards. What does that look like? What does that mean? Sat on it for a long time. And then late last year, early this year, I think inspired by games like Yuzeba's again. I mean, you'll hear me, you know, if you listen to me with any regularity, like Jay Dragon is a very meaningful designer to me. Like, I feel like I have taken a lot of inspiration from how Jay thinks about games.
Yeah.
Like Sleepaway was one of the first games I bought as an indie RPG, which really broke my brain open. And what I love about what Jay did with Yuzeba's is Jay wasn't afraid to get specific. And make the choice to have these characters be really specific.
Yes.
And like, yeah, you are playing with my characters in this world. And like, you're going to bring a lot to them. But like, these are the characters. And
yes.
I was like, I haven't been able to get that like fervor and need to finish this game. What is the most tragic, sad relationship in my life that this would be? And it was my brothers. I thought a lot about my brothers and how like, if there's somebody I could picture, A, surviving for a long time in a zombie apocalypse, yeah. B, and then, you know, B, having to, you know, deal with this sort of thing, I was like, that's what this is. That's what turned it from like, this is a neat idea and an interesting mechanic to, oh no, I have to write this, you know?
Yes.
And I think that's a turn in my brain sometimes with ideas. Like Project Echo is the same way, where I tried to crack the mechanics for a long time, and then like, finally, when you find that thing, it's all of a sudden like, oh, no. I need to do this. And for the Time We Have, that happened, you know, towards the beginning of this year. And then over the summer, I was like, what's my next project? I think it's this. And it's been a heavy game to write. And
yeah.
I played it for the first time this past weekend at time of recording. And whoo, fuck the guy who wrote it.
what a depraved person who loves the misery of others.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
The immediate thing that jumps out to me, and there's a ton of stuff, but the question I have to ask about this game is, it is so specific. It is not just a conversation in a zombie apocalypse or any apocalypse or an end of life conversation or anything like that. There's a specific setting. There's a specific genre. There's specific relationships that get, you know, kind of established early and explored certainly further. But also there's the setting of the actual conversation is specific to like, no, you're on two sides of the door. This has just happened. And like, this is this crystallized moment that you are dropped into.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the game. Like, and I say this probably too dramatically, but like, that's the non-negotiable part, right? Is like this game runs with these assumptions.
Yeah. Although the setting in the final game, the setting is malleable, but
got it. But in terms of like, you're still sliding cards across the door, right? And that sort of deal. That to me in different stages of my life seems very frightening as a game designer.
Sure.
Where it's like, no, you want to design a game so that anyone can tell any story with it, right? And certainly, you know, you kind of have some mechanics, but oh man, that's so specific. And what if someone playing it wants to not have it be on the two sides of a door, or blah, blah, they want to use tarot cards instead, or they want to blah, blah, blah. Or actually, what if it's four people that they want to be having this conversation with or whatever? And something that I really appreciate about the game, again, knowing that tabletop role-playing games are all made up and rules literally don't matter, but it's such a bold choice for me to be like, no, here's the game.
Mm-hmm.
This is the setting. This is the setup. This is the sort of story that this game is telling.
Yeah.
And you've talked a little bit about kind of that as a part of your design process and something that you really like about games, but is that something that makes you nervous? Something, you know, or something that you're like, ooh, it's not going to be for everybody.
Yeah.
Or just how do you navigate that very crystal clear perspective and setup for a game like this when you're also like, you are a small business owner and you do want as many people to buy this as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that kind of weird capitalistic and affirmation pressure.
Yes. Sometimes it makes me nervous for sure. Sometimes I doubt the choice, but there's a few key reasons. I mean, like one of the things that, and I was recently talking to Dr. Emily Friedman about this because she asked the question. She was like, I know you have an answer for this, but I want to know, why is it brothers and why did you not, you know, leave it broader?
Right, exactly.
And I was like, to give an open definition of the relationship for this game would allow people to cut the dramatic tension of the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could define your characters as strangers, and then you don't have the same level of conversation. You could change the relationship so much that you are not getting the kind of experience that the game is meant to have. And also, I wouldn't have known how to write that game in a compelling way, I think is ultimately the truth of it. Was like, I could write a game that is just two people, any two people that you define at the top or you discover in play, but it would not be 60% as compelling. You know what I mean? Like, and that's what I mean about needing to write it. It was just like, I won't make this game if it's not this specificity. So like, maybe somebody else will, like, or what have you, but like, what this game needs to be for me to feel excited about it and for me to communicate my artistic vision, to be a little dramatic, is to make it about brothers. And I think that, like, it's one of those things that, like, as our medium develops, is more and more common. And I think that I have had this as an exercise reassured by the more and more specific games that I've seen, you know, peers and people I admire make.
Yes.
We were just talking about Yuzeba's, and I think that, like, there is a world where somebody could have told Jay that would never work. You can't make people play specific characters. And some people had that reaction.
Absolutely.
But Yuzeba's is, without a doubt, one of the best games that has come out in several years. And, you know, Roan, Rook, and Deckard did it with Eat the Reich to similar success. I feel like I am walking down a path paved by some people who are much smarter than me and designers I love. But also, yeah, it does make me nervous sometimes that it won't be for everybody. But like, I hope that people appreciate the specificity and they go into it with an open mind and heart to be like, I am going into this to experience a story about what it means to be a brother, whether I am a brother or not. And for people who are brothers or have brothers, I think it will be that much more meaningful and therefore that much more special to them. But it's for everybody, you know? It's kind of like, yeah, it's specific, but it also is for everybody.
Specific, but not exclusionary. Is that a word? I don't know. It can be a word. It is
well,
right
it's
now.
Like, well, like when you think about it, and this isn't a critique of your question, but it's maybe a critique of the thought pattern that leads to it, is like, we don't ever ask if you can relate to a movie about a specific situation. You know what I mean? It's just
definitely,
like,
yeah.
I can watch a movie about a mother and daughter and sob, and I am neither mother nor daughter. You know what I mean? And I think that that's kind of what we can learn from other art forms, is that like, a compelling enough story is a compelling enough story, whether I can put myself fully into it or not.
It seemed like a core part of the concept was you again asking yourself, like, what would be the most devastating to me personally?
Sure.
Essentially, right? And believable, and who would be the most likely to survive this long in an apocalypse situation? And you mentioned, you know, kind of your brothers as being important people to you kind of earlier in the interview as well. And this game being so focused, I guess, on that sort of a relationship.
Yeah.
Do your brothers know about this game? And specifically where it's like, I was thinking about you guys when I was writing it kind of deal. Even just a small kernel or a whole, I don't know, I guess, popcorn bowl full of kernels.
Yeah. They do both know. And I actually do have a younger adopted brother and I have a younger stepsister. I don't know if the two of them know, but my oldest brother and my middle brother do know. They haven't really given me their full like response to it. I did send the audio trailer that Harlan Guthrie made to my brother Ben, and he was like, fuck, that's fucked up. And also, like, little peek into that little specific thing is that in that script, which I wrote with Harlan, the brother apologizes for totaling the other brother's car, which is a thing that happened to my two older brothers. My middle brother totaled my older brother's car. So that's a fun little way to make them just feel extra sad when they listen to it. but no, they're aware of it. And I think that, like, you know, the funny thing about brothers is it's just like it's a very unique kind of relationship. I don't know if you have a brother, but like it's a specific kind of like difficult and great relationship. Like they can be the hardest people in the world to like be emotionally vulnerable with, but also just like the people in the world that sometimes love you the fucking most. It's crazy.
Yeah, definitely. I want to ask 400 billion more questions about this. It just is like lighting my brain up and hopefully it lights up the brains of everyone else who, I don't know, might be interested in crowdfunding such a game and such an experience, just as an example of someone who might also, you know, be very inspired by this conversation. But, you know, I unfortunately have to kind of shut down that part of my brain now, that curiosity that like, wow, Elliot, such great insight on art, on creation, on collaboration, all that stuff. Again, we didn't even talk about how you manage different freelancers, blah, blah, blah. No, but it's too late.
It's too late.
It's too late. Much like for the protagonists of your apocalypse game, we now are on two sides of a proverbial door.
Very good.
Because it is time for us to face the reality of the Reckless Atok lightning round.
I'm ready.
Steel yourself, please, over these next few moments as I remind you and our listeners the situation.
My loins are girded.
You say that. Double gird them. Take this moment to gird them, maybe bless them to your whatever druidic pagan god that you ascribe to. Mm. Because the Reckless Atok lightning round is a series of questions. We ask them to every guest in the exact same order across all of the episodes of this show. There is no wrong answers to them other than ones that you lie during, just because that's kind of dumb and lame.
Yeah.
You can go on talking for minutes at a time. You can inspire you to recite multiple chapters of a Shakespeare work, whatever makes it so that you fully answer the question to your heart's content. Or it can be a simple one word, yes. Or it could be, I don't have a good answer to that question. And across all of them, I will simply nod sagely, offer no further comment, and wait and move on to the next question. Elliot, are you ready for the lightning round?
I think so.
That's what they all say. That's what they all say. We'll see. We'll test that.
We'll see.
First question. Is your glass half full or half empty?
Half full.
What excites you creatively, spiritually, and or emotionally?
Getting to see my friends win.
What does not excite you creatively, spiritually, and or emotionally?
Oh, man, when my friends lose.
What is your favorite sound?
Oh, man, in like, I'm going to say Marvel trailers is kind of the thought, but like generally big epic trailers, whenever they put just a full into a trailer, I fucking go bananas over that.
Gets you every time. Sound. You're gets the target
every
audience.
Time. Yeah. If you listen to the Project Echo soundtrack, they're full of bwahs because I was like, hey, Colin, can we put bwahs in this?
What sound do you hate?
Oh my God. The sound of my apartment building door has it rubs on the floor in certain temperatures, and it makes just the worst, most painful, high-pitched squeak ever. Mm-hmm. And it drives me nuts several times a day.
What is your favorite word?
Crisp.
What is your least favorite word?
I don't really have a problem with words like moist or anything like that. I'm trying to think if there's a word that that gets me going. I don't have one.
Good news. No wrong answers.
I love all the words.
What tabletop role-playing game and or D&D, etc., monster or antagonist, have you never faced or run that you would love to?
Oh, man. I'm looking around at my shelves. Okay, I think I would love to run Deathmatch Island, and I think the island is the antagonist in that game.
What is your favorite adventure of all time? And this can be a tabletop role-playing game adventure that you ran, that you played in, that you watched. It could be a different adventure. It could be 1999's The Mummy, whatever it means to you.
I know you sent me these questions and I could have prepared answers to them ahead of time, but
there's no wrong way to approach the Reckless Talk lightning round. It is only the approach that speaks to your soul.
Of course. Yes. Man, okay, this is a book that is appealing to me right now to say, and I think that the adventure of reading Born by Jeff Vandermeer.
Ooh. What is your favorite tabletop role-playing game character of all time? And again, this can be one you've played, an NPC that you've run or interacted with, one from a show, whatever speaks to you.
Maria James, played by Abby Hepworth in our Orbital Blues season.
Elliot, final question. What gives you hope?
I think the people that I love and the people that love me and the fact that they continue to be around gives me hope.
Elliot, congratulations. Not only have you made it to the end of the Reckless Atalk lightning round, but to Reckless Atalk, the experience TM itself.
Woo!
Thank you so much for everything. As a reward for your persistence.
Oh, a treat.
Could you please remind everyone who you are, who you have been, how they might learn more about you and support you in the future?
I have been, I will continue to be Elliot Davis, aka More Blueberries Online. You can find me at More Bloobs on Twitter. That's MoreBlueBS. You can back the time we have right now on BackerKit. Support me, help me make this game. It's my biggest swing and endeavor as a publisher, as a designer, as an artist. Or you can head to Sad Zombie Game and do it, because I bought that silly vanity URL because I thought it was funny.
It is correct. That is factual.
You can hear me GM, host, and play on Talk of the Table and My First Dungeon and maybe other places. I'm around.
Who knows? Who's to say?
Who's to say? I'm in your ears, man.
Come find out and see. Elliot, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Nathan. This was great.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.